lesson that day. A very simple lesson that I never forgot and have always practiced since. Might makes right.
I don't believe in man, God, nor devil. I hate the whole damn human race. This lesson I was taught by others. Might makes right.
Greetings, my evil fiends. This is Shane, your host of Three Ring Radio. And what I'm about to present here is the first in a slew of best of the, how do I explain this? On 9/11, September 11th of last year, I did a 24-hour radio show. It was the first. You got it? The first internet 24-hour radio show. And I did it. I did it with my lovely wife, Amy, and a friend of mine named Doug. He did the illustration for Might is Right, all of the illustrations. And so we presented a 24-hour broadcast last year on September 11th to commemorate the re-release of Might is Right, a book I published, republished with the Anton LaVey foreword. And so this is the first part, like I said, in a slew, a whole wad of best ofs. I'm going to try to cut up that 24-hour show into as many pieces as I can. But this one is featuring Peter Gilmore, High Priest of the Church of Satan. And he came on after about, I think he came on at the 22-hour mark. So he was one of our last guests. And so we're a little loopy, to say the least. I hope you enjoy this and check out threeringradio.com for all the Three Ring Radio shows and show announcements. Enjoy this slice of history.
Won't do. A man must have faith and courage even to be a pirate. He who does not believe in anything does not believe in himself, which is atheism of the worst kind. A religion is essential. Nobility of action is impossible without it. Faith is an integral part of all heroic and noble natures. What is religion but a man's way of thinking, his philosophical belief, his code of ethics and of action? Hence, when one religion dies out in a true man's heart, another immediately takes its place. He must believe something, or else sit down to contemplate his navel and rot into nothingness, as the Buddhists teach. The negative life won't do. Remember that.
We're on with Peter Gilmer. Hi, Peter.
Hi, how you all doing holding up now after your marathon?
Oh, yeah, good. A little crazed.
You can see the finish line.
That's good.
I guess we need to make proper introductions since George Eric Hawthorne called us out on that.
Oh, he did he?
Yeah, so we have the artist that drew some of the illustrations for the new printing of Might is Right in the studio.
Oh, excellent.
His name's Doug.
It's good to have creative people on board.
We have my beautiful wife, Amy, and me. We've met.
Yes, indeed.
We had a lovely lunch.
And we have one of the gentlemen from the black metal band Usurper sitting, waiting for, you know, he's coming on next. So he's in the
Cheers.
Background. Say hey.
Hey.
I've never heard their music.
Oh, well, we have to send you a CD. They're wicked good black metal.
Stay tuned. You'll get to hear them.
Here, Rick? You got to give him a CD.
Oh, yeah.
So how are you today, Peter?
Oh, doing fine. There is a very interesting mood in New York, of course, being the anniversary of the attacks in 2001. And you kind of notice a gravity in the air that makes everybody kind of stop and think and realize their vulnerability all over.
Yeah, I have a couple friends in New York, and I know I've read some of your writings about what happened, and it's definitely a different feel here than there.
Oh, I would imagine, yeah.
You know, so...
Well, you know, we were living in a golden age of real freedom before the 9/11 attacks. People here really felt that they didn't have to worry that someone would actually violate the social contract on that level. It was really naive, and it was proven to be such that day. But that era may be gone forever now.
You said the New York seemed to stop and think today. I've been to New York a few times, and the masses there didn't seem to have the capability to stop and think.
Well, the masses don't, but there are enough people that do, and even those who are mental sluggards, they can tap into the feel in the air. It's something more primal than higher conscious thought.
So what did you make of September 11th, the attacks, a call to arms against fundamentalism?
Exactly, precisely. What 9/11 showed us was that fanatical fundamentalists are poison to a social contract. And I like the idea of a social contract because it allows me to spend my time on pursuits other than just trying to keep food on my table and defend what possessions I have. So those kind of folks are a danger, and it doesn't matter whether they're Islamic or Christian or whatever kind of religion. If they have that kind of fanaticism, where they want to destroy anybody who does not think as they do, then they have to be recognized as the rabid dogs they are and eventually weeded out from a secular culture.
What did you feel about the cleanup work that some of the academics tried to do immediately thereafter, claiming that that was not the face of the true Islam?
Well, again, Islam does have a whole group and range of sects. But when you look at the early history of Islam, they were very hostile to anybody who didn't believe as they did, much as the Christians were. It took a long time for Christianity to be placed in a position where they didn't have a unity with governmental powers that could exercise conversion or death. So in time, Islam over the world may reach a point where it's not linked with governments with weapons or with members that can get a hold of weapons that can destroy people. I mean, the situation in Israel is a very... one to think about, because there's a relatively small group of suicidal individuals are slaughtering people by the day with bombing runs. They're not afraid to die. They think they're getting some kind of illusory heavenly reward, and those people are absolutely dangerous.
But do you really feel that's the case? I mean, you know, these people have had, the Palestinians have had everything they own taken from them. They've been forced to move into refugee camps. and the Israelis still come in with tanks and blow them up, and every time there is a suicide bombing, these people are flying their choppers over and bombing refugee camps, which seems to be an oxymoron of the whole idea of a refugee camp. I mean, these people are desperate people. They have no weapons.
Uh-oh.
They have nothing. What choice do they have? I think if I were in that situation, I might strap a bomb to myself, too.
Oh, you might, but then you're dead. You have no more life to live. And the whole point is...
But they don't have a life now. I mean, they've lost it all.
They could find... I think they might find ways to have a different kind of life than what they expected. We have to always adapt. Remember, we're talking about Might is Right as our basic issue here for this day. And the book that's just out. We want to remind people, buy the book.
Thank you.
If you basically are attacking a power that has more might than you do, then you can only expect to be slaughtered. So going in there and blowing up Israelis is going to have reprisals, just like blowing up buildings in this nation had reprisals for the nations that harbored those people. You really have to keep aware of who has the power in the situation. And one, you can't be idealistic. You can't say, I want my life to always be the way it is. That may not be possible. You have to adapt and find a life that's going to be as satisfying for you as it can be, but it may not necessarily be an ideal that you have. You have to be pragmatic about it. And I don't think they're being pragmatic.
But what about, like, the Revolutionary War and the Americans against the British? I mean, people would have said the same thing. I'm sure people in Britain were saying that about the silly Americans.
Yeah, but America had the power to pull it off, and did. And that's Might Again Made Right. They had the might. They did it. They had help from France. And, again, it's all a matter of power and balances of power. If the Palestinians could have the right kind of allies, they wouldn't have to be committing suicide all the time.
I think Might is Right could be taken either way in that case. You could say Israel has the upper hand. They should be able to take the upper hand. They should be able to expand their borders. If they've got the might, it makes right. But also you could say that if the Palestinians can display any type of might and they're feeling that they're oppressed, they should do whatever they can.
Well, the thing is, everybody will. That's always what happens. You know, Might is Right isn't something that you have to try to promote. It's how things work. It's simply a definition of a reality, so that everyone will struggle for what they want, whether it's idealistic or pragmatic, and whoever wields the most power will eventually win and rewrite the history so that they look like they were doing the right thing all along, depending on their audience.
I agree. And I think Might is Right basically says how it is, not how it should be or how we will make it. That's the way it is.
Exactly. It's reality. It's not ideals.
It's a philosophy of realism.
Mm-hmm. Precisely.
I think what most people, it seems, even within internal chat rooms and everything else, don't seem to understand, and it must grow annoying to you, is the fundamental atheism of LaVey and Satanism.
Oh, that does get kind of tiresome. And, you know, we thought those people cleared out in 1975, but they kind of creep back in now and again. You know, the real thing with Satanism is that it isn't spiritual. It's carnal. It's material. And the folks that try to bring some kind of spiritualism into it are really missing the point. That it's about living your life for the here and now, not dealing with some kind of mystical mumbo-jumbo. Go be a Wiccan or a Setian or something if that's your taste in things. I mean, we don't care if people really think that way, but it certainly isn't what the Church of Satan is about.
Peter, throughout our broadcast, I think we've touched on a number of times the problems with infighting and pettiness within the Church of Satan. What do you think about that? I mean, don't you think that all of that ends up holding people back?
Well, you know, I don't really see much pettiness or infighting in the Church of Satan. I think that it becomes an illusion for people who are online, who might bicker with each other, but those amount of people you can count on several hands, and really is such a minuscule drop in the ocean of the thousands of members we have in the Church of Satan that it's really not even worth considering. It's just, you know, minor people with big mouths when they're online. But the real people who count in the Church of Satan as in real life are the ones who are out there really making something happen. They're producing things, they're doing books, they're doing movies, they're doing radio shows, they're doing music, they're doing all kinds of things. And, you know, they're too busy to waste their lives in bickering and infighting. Those are the people who don't seem to have much better to do. And those kind of people are worth ignoring.
Well, they seem they're the ones who maintain this mainly for the image, for the identity. Rather than building one of their own, they're latching on to something that was prefabricated for them.
Well, there are so many people who are like that in the world, that they're looking for an identity and they want to hang their hat on something. But those kind of folks often will move on to something else if they don't get what they want out of what they think is the source for the identity. Like, they want to be somehow catered to. And the Church of Satan isn't about catering to people. So those kind of folks sort of move on fairly quickly. At least we've seen that over the many years that we've been involved. So it solves itself. It's a wonderful organic organization that does weed out those kind of people in time.
Do you see the Church of Satan as progressing and moving into a different phase?
Well, the phase now is really one where we are expanding on all of the foundations and developments that we've had over the past years, that we are now in a position with the current technology and our worldwide reach and instantaneous touch with people in just about every nation on the globe to really get the kind of ideas out there that we want to explore, that people can really find out immediately now what Satanism really is instead of listening to you know, I mean, intelligent people can. Like, of course, naturally, we're dealing with the human species, and 90% of it is worthless. But the intelligent folks have instant access to knowing what we're really about. And if they're carnal people who are in tune with our kind of symbols, then they can be part of our movement. And that's certainly a power that is growing in leaps and bounds right now in the organization. We're at the strongest point we've ever been.
What would you do if you were Emperor of America right now?
Emperor of America. I don't know if I'd want to do that, because I probably wouldn't have enough time to enjoy myself. There'd be far too many responsibilities that would be just amazingly boring.
Would you instate a eugenics policy?
Well, I think that that is definitely something that needs to be done in time. We have to, especially since we're cracking the genetic code, we're getting to the point where we'll be able to design the kind of offspring and further generations that we're going to have. I think that's really an important thing for our species on the whole. Like, we've understood that a sort of diversity of breeding has brought interesting results. And, you know, humans, of course, breed animals to try to bring the best, and I don't see why we don't apply that to ourselves.
I couldn't agree more.
Eugenics, of course, as you folks probably know, didn't have a bad name until the excesses of the Third Reich. It was totally promoted by most intellectuals throughout the Western world. I even have a book on my shelf promoting eugenics, and it was endorsed by the Episcopalian Church. So you can't get more conservative than that. So, you know, it really was an idea that was around, and it was tainted because of misdirected use of it, but it's something that in time should be restored, because it's the only way to actually evolve our species. What we see is, when we look back over human history, that physically we don't seem to have evolved much at all over the course of recorded history that we know. And if we really want to change ourselves, the time may be to take active measures to do so, to see what could be better and to do that. And, of course, there may be mistakes along the way, as there always are when progress is happening.
Well, the idea is that we haven't been evolving, but, in fact, we've been regressing. That's dysgenics, because the stupidest people are capable of spitting out the most children now.
Sure. Of course, we've set up
before
a situation where folks who basically aren't contributing in many instances are allowed to do whatever they want to and then keep reproducing. But, you know, in the end, those aren't the people who really will move society anyway. And we always have to look towards the fact that we're always dealing with a stratification pyramid, and that the majority of people are always going to be relatively worthless. And I think even throughout history, if we look at who was breeding most, it was the kind of worthless people anyway. So,
Peter,
I don't really see that's so much of a big change, that it's really always part. Because, you know, if we look at really ancient history, the majority of the classes that were out there were slave classes who were being put to use to build the architecture and all the cultural elements. The folks who were doing the art and the priesthood and the aristocracy were always the tiniest tip of that pyramid, and that really hasn't changed so much.
But what about the fact that in ancient times the royalty was mostly inbreeding? Brothers and sisters and cousins were forced to marry and reproduce.
Yeah, well, that ended up causing a lot of genetic trouble too, didn't it? So, you know, the thing is, at a certain point in European history, they were often looking outside of their own particular houses to foreign royalty to breed, and that was a good idea, that it created some genetic diversity and again, produced some interesting results and, of course, some poor results too. But like those folks didn't have any deep knowledge of how breeding works or genetics at all. You know, with the knowledge that we have, plus the cracking of the genome, there's just so much more that can really be done. And it would be interesting to see it happen. And, of course, it will on some level. The thing is, once the knowledge is there, people will use it, whether it's done overtly or done covertly, which is more likely with something like that that's so unpopular. It will happen.
I believe the numbers are kept fairly secret, but can you give us an estimate of the annual growth of the membership of the Church of Satan?
I really can't say that. Anton LaVey created a policy of not letting people know our membership at all, because if it seems to be too many, we look like a threat, and if it seems to be too little, people won't take us seriously. So that's
what
something we really don't discuss.
Yours,
I mean, we do have thousands of people worldwide, and we get people almost joining every single day. So,
what business is that of yours, Doug?
I don't know. I've already run into people.
Are you an accountant, IRS, what?
Everybody wants to know.
Why?
And it's fun
that's
to keep it a mystery.
Question I've ever heard. No, I'm joking, Doug. Not the stupidest, but one. I don't understand what the hell that question is. You know, why?
It's a natural question. I mean,
it is?
You want to know, yeah.
No, it is. It is. Most people ask, and then, you know, I give the standard answer that I just did.
Well, I don't feel any better about most people asking, but I still don't think it's a stupid question.
Well, I'm tired, okay, Doug? I'm short. I'm right. I just want to punch you because I've been looking at you for 24 hours.
I still got this knife.
Now.
Yes.
Have something good to drink and relax.
Oh, we will. Once we had to take you very seriously. After this, it's the black metal band. You know, we're going downhill from here.
Yeah, or uphill for some parts of the audience, though.
So how much of the show have you listened to, and what have you thought so far?
We only really came in towards the latter part, because we've been really kind of busy today.
So did you hear Tom Metzger?
No, we missed him, because we sort of went out to have dinner before he was on. You were playing some speeches that were recorded with George Hawthorne and somebody else, and...
Right, you emailed me and said white power less.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So you're not, you don't have any appreciation for the white power movement.
Well, I appreciate what they are, which is generally desperate, powerless people who are looking for an identity to somehow give themselves some kind of self-confidence. And those people are generally fairly empty inside, and I feel sad for them, because a lot of them, if they'd not linked themselves into something idealistic and would concentrate on their own personal well-being, they might achieve it. This way, they're making themselves pariahs who are watched by a lot of factors in our society, which will just make their lives miserable. It's not going to give them a better life.
So what'd you think of the last printing of Might is Right, the one I did with when Anton LaVey originally gave me the foreword, and then I had the George Eric Hawthorne afterward and the Katja Lane editor's note?
Oh, it was fascinating. It was a good addition because it brought a lot more information to go with the book, and it showed that there's a whole range of people who find inspiration from those texts.
Do you agree with Dr. LaVey's theory, with the Jack London theory?
I think that's a good possibility. I personally haven't done the kind of research to make any kind of real convincing for myself about it. You know, I hear what all these different people say, and I haven't looked at the manuscript, so I really can't say. If I did, I might have something more definite to say about that.
Okay.
Can't say one way or another, because I really don't know. But I think it's a fascinating theory, and certainly there's enough evidence there to lend itself some credibility. But so there may really indeed be several people who are involved in it, because the writing style isn't consistent through the whole text.
All right, stop me if this is another dead question. But
stop.
All right.
No, I'm joking.
All right. But how did you come to be into the Church of Satan? How did you meet LaVey and come to be on the Council of Nine and ultimately...
Well, basically, I read the Satanic Bible when I was 13 years old. I saw it in a bookstore and said, well, you know, I've read the rest of the religious texts, the main major texts, and found them all to be basically mythology. And I thought, well, here's something that looks like another take on it. So I purchased the book, read it, and prior to that, I basically considered myself an atheist. And then I read that and said, you know, I guess there's another name for me. The name is Satanist. And I basically considered myself a Satanist from the moment I read that book. And later I, you know, wrote to Anton LaVey and joined the Church of Satan and was invited to meet him and became a good friend and colleague. And, you know, we had a relationship that got stronger as the years went by. So what was the same with my wife, too. I actually, when I was in high school, I introduced her to the Satanic Bible, and she also felt that it was, it represented her philosophy. And so we both joined when we were in college, the Church of Satan, and we both received the invitation to meet Anton LaVey, and we did. And it really was magical. It progressed from there, and we would never regret it. It was really a fascinating experience and a great journey.
The chat room wants to know about your upcoming book.
I've got to get the Black Flame out first, and then I'll put my book out. I keep rewriting it and adding new things, so I've got to, like, at a certain point, smack my hand and say, no, just leave it alone and put it out. Most of my past essays I've had in the Black Flame and other places, some of which have been expanded, and a bunch of new ones, too, that haven't been printed anywhere. And it has my Rite of Ragnarok ritual that was in a Swedish publication years ago, and the official Satanic Wedding Rite and Satanic Funeral Rite that I wrote that are in use through our priesthood for our members these days. So I hope to get it out by early 2004. That's the plan for now.
You have a publisher?
We're going to do it ourselves because we want complete control over it.
Is that Hell's Kitchen?
Yes.
That's the best way to do it.
Yeah, it really is, because it'll look exactly like I want. You know, some people have approached us about it, but then the whole thing is they want to get an editor involved, and you just don't want to do that. I really want this to be precisely the way I want it to be. So I'll design it, I'll produce it, and there it will go. So the only person to blame will be me.
Well, I always find someone else to blame. No, I'm just kidding.
Well, that takes creative effort, and that's a good thing.
Well, I forgot what I was going to ask. Boy, that's a good one.
Uh-oh, time to do a shot for anyone listening.
Oh! No, what were you going to... Oh, Doug was asking you earlier. You missed the question. He was asking if you could give us a brief synopsis of your book.
Oh, well, basically, it's essays and ritual. And the essays are some of the ones that I had in The Black Flame. Some of them are expanded, too. And a bunch of new ones that no one's seen yet. And the ritual for the Satanic Marriage Funeral and the Rite of Ragnarok.
So now, Peter, getting back to, I guess, the anniversary that today is, you being in New York have kind of a different view. So what is your opinion of President Bush and how he's handled the whole thing and the war on terrorism and all that stuff?
Well, that, again, you know, we don't really know all of what's going on there. I think that the media gives us a certain portion. And I hear from people in the military some other things, and that, you know, Bush has never struck me as a particularly intelligent fellow, but he does have some smart people around him. You know, the war on terror is something that is, he seems to bring all these Christian moral issues to it, which I am against. But I do like the idea of trying to preserve our society from having terrorists attacking it, and if we need to go crush them elsewhere, then that's a wise thing. You know, America has the might. We should wield it. Might is right. You know, we have to use the power. We don't have the greatest army and technology on earth to not use it. And I really think that we're in a point where we have this war of secularism versus religious fanaticism. And Bush doesn't understand that because he's a religious person. That he's trying to make it into some kind of holy war of essentially, I really think, you know, his commentary to, you know, pro-Islam or types of Islam to the, you know, exception. That on a certain level, most Christians really do feel that it's a war of some kind of Christian ethic against Islam, and they don't see that kind of Christianity is practically the same. So we really have to focus it. I think that's the problem, that the awareness of the real issues behind this war on terrorism are not clear with our leaders, at least in their public speaking. It may be that there are some very pragmatic people behind it who are doing it for economic reasons, and other reasons that are really just using these trappings to try to manipulate society into going along with it. But again, all of that will remain hidden, as most of that kind of stuff usually does, and only eventually we may find out the real motivations behind everything.
The most threatening terrorist, in my mind, to our freedoms is John Ashcroft.
Yeah. Well, you know, essentially that Patriot Act, which people are definitely revolting against, is really a slap in the face of the Constitution.
So, say that again.
Aren't you almost tempted to vote for Bush again to kind of force the hand of backlash, so to speak?
Well, you know, we'll have to see how that happens. The thing is, the herd always goes along with the flow, unfortunately, and the herd can't really take real freedom. Once unlimited choices are before them, they're frightened. They need limited selections, like one from column A, one from column B, and they can then feel they're free because they get to choose one or the other. That's the kind of freedom that most people can handle and tolerate. The thing is, the kind of freedom that, we sort of folks want, which is something that the Founding Fathers wove into our Constitution, is something that does have to be fought for because the marching morons don't want it and don't need it and don't understand it. So that's really kind of a responsibility to, the real free thinkers in the future, is to try to keep that Constitution solid. And we have members who are in government and in, law who are working towards that. So.
And that's why we grow to hate the mob.
That end right now.
We grow to hate them because we don't need their laws.
We don't want that kind of law.
What kind of law do we want?
Well, a law that, keeps things organized and allows the people who can handle freedom to have it. It's not egalitarian. Egalitarianism is grotesque because it's basically trying to say everybody's the same and they're not. Most people don't have the ability to handle the kind of responsibility of a broad freedom. The whole point is, a lot of Satanists might say, okay, I want to advocate fascism, but the whole thing is, unless you're in the very top of the pyramid of the administration of the fascist regime, you're basically going to be sacrificed to the state. So that's not a good position to be in. The whole point is always being, we're trying to advocate a secular society that does have freedom for those who can handle it. And that's something subtle and difficult to maintain, because in the United States, the way it seems to work is we have a consumer economy where most of the herd is basically led by apples put out there on sticks by corporations. The whole thing is that's fine. If that's their bread and circuses, it keeps them satisfied. But what we have to hope for, we fringe types, is that we're not going to be caught up in, being squeezed out of having our own alternatives to those kind of choices.
So would you say we need more freedoms or less, or is there a balance? I mean, I personally think drugs should be legal, and if you kill yourself on them, go ahead.
Oh, yeah,
but the laws we do enforce,
that.
We should enforce, possibly with death in most cases.
Even speeding tickets?
You know, I'm hoping that, there's a problem now that the kind of folks who don't want people in general to be free can use security is a reason for stealing freedoms from us, and that's a very big danger that we're facing right now.
Absolutely.
So we have to be vigilant about that. And the thing is, there is a tradition in this country of trying to preserve that kind of freedom, and then we're about the only nation on earth that has that. A lot of European folk may be very critical of the United States, but when you look at their governments, they're usually hand in glove with the Catholic or other churches and are quite happy to prosecute people for blasphemy. So this is the only nation, especially of long-standing existence, that has that kind of tradition. And because it's there and on paper, and it's been given almost a sacred kind of approach, it's something that we can stand on and try to make certain that it isn't whittled away. We're lucky. Our founding fathers were very satanic individuals, and this really was the first satanic republic. It's not a democracy, it's a republic, and it's a good thing, too. Those guys were smart.
Do you think our culture is degenerating into decadence, and this is a sign that there's a new coming fascism?
Hmm.
Hey, Peter, can you hear that train?
Sounds like ominous. is it running you guys down?
Yeah, I live in between two train tracks. It's really interesting.
Wow. The question is interesting because we really need to define what's decadence. Sometimes. Periods that are called decadent are ones where some very interesting artistic expression can happen because it's breaking away from a period beforehand that was very repressive. So decadence can be a positive thing if you look at it in that sense. If you look at decadence as being the rise of rampant mediocrity, which is something that I see happening in our culture, then that's not such a good thing.
Oh, I'm not against decadence, but I was wondering if you saw the parallel or recognize a parallel between the United States today and Weimar Berlin before the Nazism.
There are some similarities, certainly, and history does, of course, seem to run in cycles for those who aren't aware of it. We'll have to see how it goes. See, again, Germany at that point didn't have the kind of tradition of supporting freedom that we have. It came from a very chaotic history. We don't have a chaotic history here. We have a very solid 200 years of promoting freedom. So there's a very big difference there. So the results could be quite different when time passes. But we're here to witness it. It's the greatest show on earth, and we're all part of it.
Were you talking about this radio show?
that's a good manifestation of it. Yes, let's say that.
It's a symptom of the cultural decadence.
But you guys have been sort of spending the day trying to shock people and get them paying attention. And
yeah, exactly. A brick upside the head.
Yeah, well, so this is the sort of the Howard Stern version of Radio Free Satan at the moment.
I guess so.
Is that what you think?
Well, that's great.
Well, that's good. You know,
I thought we were a little more cerebral than that, but I'm just sleep deprived, perhaps.
Hey, we didn't want to be, okay? We just couldn't get the strippers or anyone in here, okay?
Well, next time. We have to make it a regular feature and have to see what kind of people you can get in for the next time.
Exactly.
There's a question from the chat room from Bill M. He wants to know about how you feel about people who are Satanists but don't ever use rituals in their lives.
Oh, fine. There's a lot of people in our church who are like that. They feel that their creative work is ritual enough for them. You know, the technique of ritual magic is basically self-transformational. And if you have other means of doing your self-transformation, then you don't need to do that. The thing is, we think it is a very valid and useful tool, and a lot of folks who don't try it, when they finally take the plunge, see that it's very effective to them because they've resisted it, and it affects them more psychologically in a deeper way than, say, somebody who ritualizes all the time and it's become old hat to.
Wow. When I first read the Satanic Bible, that's the one part I just couldn't get through.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Well, for me, too, when I first read it when I was 13, being a hardcore atheist and materialist, I said, well, what's all this magical stuff? And the whole point is it's something you have to try on for size, see how it works for you. And you don't have to. It's not a requirement. It's there as an option. So, and again, many of our members do not ever go there. It doesn't have any validity for them. And again, Satanism is a user-friendly religion. So you use the part that works for you. And if that doesn't, no, you don't need to. Don't worry.
Amy? You were just waving like you had a question.
No, I wasn't.
Oh. I thought you were going to ask him about TV as God and your religion.
Yes, Peter, what do you think of the TV ministry and the notion that television is the modern God?
Oh, well, it obviously is. You know, everybody worships that eye, that it is the collective mind that is held by, you know, many, many heads. And it's just obvious. You watch everybody. What are they talking about? They're all talking about, like, Survivor or some stupid show that they're watching. You know, it's what supplies them with values and thoughts, what passes for thinking these days. These little idea bites that people mull over and over. So, yeah, it's certainly their gods.
They even call it reality now.
Oh, yeah, well, that's the funny part. It's like these amazingly manufactured entertainments, it's reality TV, and it's like, no, it isn't.
So do you watch it?
Anything that's created is an edited, stylized version of reality from a particular perspective.
Do you watch it or do you entirely avoid it?
Hmm?
Do you watch it or do you entirely avoid it?
It as in TV or reality TV?
Oh, TV, reality TV, whatever.
I haven't watched any of the reality TV shows because if I want to watch something, I want professionals to be entertaining me on the highest level.
No American Idol?
Nope. Well, see, if somebody edited me the best lousy parts, the funny people, that I might watch just for amusement's sake. But I wouldn't sit through the rest of it because somebody might just be mediocre and not be absolutely awful. So I'd want to really see the awful stuff because that would be funny.
Yeah, that's what. Yeah, that's good stuff.
So if somebody has to do that, put together an edited version of the lousiest people, that I'd watch. But you know, I think TV. If there's some entertainment on there that might be well crafted, but it's mostly just junk. You know, I prefer to buy DVDs of movies that I like and watch those.
But that's still watching the TV. I mean, you know, I hear that from a lot of people, even the people from Radio Free Satan. They always tell me, well, we don't watch TV, but they watch videos and they work on their computer. It's the same thing. They're just the children of the television.
Well, it depends on you know, the cathode ray tube, and now it's going to be the LCD screen or plasma screen, you know, is ubiquitous in our life. The thing is, I was away for a couple of weeks recently and never looked at a computer screen and didn't watch television, and I felt fine. Didn't feel withdrawal. You know, for me, it's a tool, like all the other tools I have, whether I'm sitting at my synthesizer or whether I'm, you know, playing an instrument or whether I'm reading a book. All these things are tools for me. And I think the balanced person sees it that way. They don't feel a compulsion towards these things. They're just your arsenal. They're like, you know, you use a knife, a fork, a keyboard, whatever. Use what you need to accomplish what you want.
Well, I think anything beyond that would be religious fanaticism anyway, whether you replace TV with God or Satan or, you know, Allah or whatever, if it reaches a point where you can't function without it.
Sure.
And I guess that is fanaticism, and that isn't healthy for anybody.
No, it isn't. You know, but for some people who are hollow inside, it's how they live their lives and how they're so easily manipulated. But those are spiritual people. The people who are addicted to television are spiritual. That's their spiritualism. It's their, what comes from outside to fill their empty inside.
Exactly.
Interesting.
Because we Satanists are carnal folk. Like, what we have inside fills us and comes out. We're not sucking things in. You know, we might appreciate things that other people create that are creative and enrich us, but it's by choice. You pick and choose the ones you like. You criticize the ones that you don't like. You learn from them, especially if you're going to be creating something that's going to go out there and needs to be out in the realm of the marketplace. You have to understand what's out there and how you're going to handle that. You know, you can't cut yourself off from the world if you want to make headway in it. That's just foolish.
Okay, here's one. There's been a recent republication of the book.
Might is right.
No.
Oh.
Sexuality, Perversion, and Magic, I think in that order.
Oh, yeah.
Francis King.
Yes, the Francis King book, yeah.
Well, he claims that there's secret, so you might not be able to say anything, internal Church of Satan sex rites or sex rituals that are practiced. What's the credibility to this?
Let me tell you, my wife, okay?
Did you read this?
Yeah, no, I read the book. It's a fun book, and, you know, that was really just kind of hype. You know, the people can invent their own sexual rituals. You know, sexuality can certainly be part of personal magic. It's not something that you usually do in a group setting, of course, because that kind of mechanical fornication is just for people who aren't creative sexually. You know, there's no mandated sex rituals in Satanism. We don't have that. We don't need it. Because for us, sex is a natural function of life, like eating. You know, we don't ritualize having dinner, so we don't ritualize our sex. So, you know, you should be a sexual gourmet, and that usually is something you don't need to do in the ritual chamber. But, you know, if a couple, you know, wanted to do that, then more power to them, as long as it stimulates them. But we don't have any doctrine and no listed secret sex rites. But if people want to think that, well, you know, then we get the wrong people applying.
You know, my wife goes, Peter, what happened to the horror? You were writing this horror book or group.
Oh, that's our horror. Yeah, that's a.
What's the title?
It's called GRUE, G-R-U-E, and it's a horror short fiction. We haven't published it in a while simply because the market is lousy for short fiction in horror. The whole publishing industry decided that horror was a bad subgenre. They had to, like, drop that. If you go to bookstores, it doesn't say horror anymore.
Great, Amy. Amy's doing a website, Horror of Horror, and doing all of her horror stories.
Yeah, well, you know, it's something that out there in the marketplace is not so saleable at this point. It really dropped. We came into it many years ago when it actually was, you know, embraced, and the magazine won all kinds of awards and got out there to a lot of different people, and some major screenwriters now are people that we published some of their first work in our early issues.
Wow.
So, you know, we really tapped some great people over the course, but these days, you know, you print the magazine and you can't really sell it. So we're not fools. We're not just throwing money down the drain. So what we're going to do is wait for a while when we feel we have some really top-notch stories. Again, we'll publish another issue, but we're really not actively running out to do it because it really is something that's not going to sell.
It seems like for the last 5 or 10 years, there's no horror sections in bookstores. Even Clive Barker, you don't find him in the horror section. You'll find him in, like, fantasy or whatever. Fiction or something. Ever since, I think, Robert Bloch died, it was the death of horror.
Yeah, he loved GRU, too. We used to send him copies, and he always sent us nice responses, like thoughtfully considering our issues.
Robert Bloch?
Yep.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, Rob Bloch is a really cool guy, and a really sweet guy to meet and talk to, too. Yeah, you know, really, when people like him are gone, and, you know, Richard Matheson is really not producing anything, and You know, all the good old folks are really not out there doing stuff, and the people that are out there are calling themselves dark fantasy or something like that. And, you know, the real gutsy horror needs to be revived, and it will. It'll happen. You know, it'll definitely come back and be marketable again. But, you know, that always goes up and down. It got glutted, unfortunately, and there was a lot of real crap being published by the major publishing houses. There's a sort of good old boy network of authors that we would even see at the conventions, and a lot of stuff was just getting out there that really was kind of mediocre, and there seemed to have been an audience backlash, that there was just so much stuff that really wasn't up to a high level. People said, you know, horror seems to suck. So they stopped buying it. And then they changed the name of what was out there being published under horror to dark fantasy, and then tried to find a new market, and it just isn't so big.
It was like every book was in a small New England town.
Yeah, well, you know, people got really derivative, and again, you know, like, you look at somebody like Richard Matheson, who really created so much of what Stephen King did. If you read I Am Legend, which is really
book.
The sort of commonplace horror in the contemporary world, and Robert Bloch as well, that these people really did something that again, like, became massively selling under people like Stephen King and Dean Koontz. And, you know, they made millions of dollars, whereas the people who really set the standard for it, like, never got that kind of recognition. And which is always the way things work. There's always a popularizer. There's somebody who's the original thinker, and then somebody popularizes it. I mean, look at Windows out there. You know, that absolutely lousy OS, and that's what everybody has. Whereas there are superior ones out there, but they're not so widespread.
Well, the Necronomicon, wasn't that a poorly hacked piece of shit? Please tell us you didn't take any of that seriously.
Oh, you mean the Simon Necronomicon?
The one they made up in the 70s just to see if they could.
Yeah. That one, I have a whole thing about it on the website. I actually talked to Herman Slater, who was in on the creation of that. And it was basically meant to take advantage of people who thought it was real. The idea was that everybody kept coming in to occultists saying, I want the Necronomicon. So they thought, well, we can whack something together. We'll sell it, and people will buy it. And they did. You know, Avon published as a mass paperback after the original leather-bound hardcover that looked really wonderful. And they made a fortune.
I can respect them doing that. I just can't respect the people buying it.
Oh, well, the people buying it are idiots. You know, the people, that's why I have that the whole thing about it on the website. People are like, oh, I read the Necronomicon, and I'm like, well, if you think that's a valid book, then you're an idiot. But the whole point is, if you like the rituals in Necronomicon, you know, you don't believe in them, but if you like the trappings in there, they certainly can be useful to you, like anything can be. You know, anything can work towards your own ritualization if it turns you on in some way, if it's a stimulus. So it doesn't matter that it has any kind of reality, because all the gods are fantasy. You know, in ritual, you can call on the names of any gods that exist or any ones you want to make up. Anyone's from fiction, because they're all equally fictional. So that's its only validity, is if it stimulates you, you can use it, but don't believe it's real.
See, as I was saying earlier this morning, it's part of the magician's protocol or whatever to be able to draw things even from fiction that's labeled as fiction, and not just the fiction that's labeled as fact, like a lot of the occultic things written. And people don't understand about Aleister Crowley. He took his idea for the Abbey of Phloema and all the rest of it from Rabelais' Gargantua and Pantagruel.
Right, right.
And yet you see hacks like Nicholas Schreck writing how Crowley understood and LaVey took from fiction.
Well, you know, you can't deal with mystical, constipated people like that. They're really never going to see what reality is, and the axes that they're grinding are many. So,
well, I just don't understand how this guy can consider himself a legitimate magician where he's completely discounted anything he could have gotten from any fictional work, when, of course, a fictional work, to be effective, has to be evocative towards your psyche or your,
well, exactly.
Your own reality.
We're dealing with somebody who isn't evocative and is the epitome of anti-charisma. So,
it's just
the obvious why a person like that thinks that way.
That's right.
Well, Peter, we're gonna let you go, I think, here.
Okay.
I wanted to ask you a couple more questions, though.
Go ahead.
Real quick. Black metal.
Mm-hmm.
Any preferences?
I don't listen to it.
None of it, huh?
Nope, none of it. The only music I listen to is orchestral music, and it's usually, and some chamber music, but basically from Beethoven on and the contemporary film scores. It's the stuff I listen to, it's the stuff I write.
How's your, is your CD out yet?
It should be very soon. The Threnody for Humanity CD should be coming back from the manufacturer like any day now.
Yeah, the cover art's really nice.
Yeah, Steve Kasner did a brilliant job. You know, it's subtle and again evocative, as you said before, isn't it? Which is something that you want. That I hope that people will enjoy the music. It was stuff that was used in the Death Scenes movies, and but I brought it back to its original stage before it was edited into the films and remixed it. So I think people will be hearing it differently than they did from those soundtracks.
So you did the score for the Death Scene movies?
2 and 3, yeah.
Oh, I thought LaVey did that stuff.
No, he did the narration for the first one.
Right, I remember that.
Yeah, but the second and third, the music in those two mostly is mine. Like, there was some source music as well, but that was my stuff.
Where do you see Satanism in the next, let's say, 10 or 20 years?
In 10 or 20 years, it'll be more deeply entrenched. I think that it will still seem dangerous to a lot of people, and that's a good thing. But it will also be something that more intelligent folks will find acceptable, that they will see it and will say, that is an alternative that I can embrace because it's a label that is still stimulating and not something that is going to destroy their own connection with the real world that they're trying to conquer.
Excellent.
So it'll keep expanding, I'm certain of that.
Excellent. You guys, anything? Anything in closing?
How long until we have a satanic president, do you think?
Well, we've had some in the past that were rather satanic.
Bill Clinton was pretty goddamn satanic.
Yeah, well, look at Teddy Roosevelt. You know, look at our history. We've had some people that had some very satanic inclinations. We will continue. See, the people who are in power on some level are using satanic principles. They have to, because to rule the world, we have the basic understanding of how it works. So they may be flying under different banners, but the ones who really control things and understand things, they will be satanic on some level. Or what will happen is that they'll be manipulated by people who are satanic, who use them as puppets, which has often happened in the past with world rulers. So there you go.
Wow. Well, thanks so much for taking the time to talk with us today.
It's been an absolute pleasure.
Yeah, Peter, this was great. Thanks a lot, man.
You're welcome, and I hope that you completely kick ass with selling the books.
Yeah, me too.
Thank you very much.
So far.
Okay.
Again, thanks a lot, Peter.
You're very welcome. Have a wonderful rest of your evening.
Yeah, and you know, stick around for 30 seconds. Listen to this broadcast, because you just got to hear a little bit of this nice black metal music.
Okay.
Talk to you later, man.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right. You pussies.
I'm so tired.
I am Shane. On me, White Hunt. All right. I just tuned in. This is about taking a long fucking sword, fucking going on a killing spree, and fucking killing everyone in sight just because this one is about killing. Kill. Kill. Kill or be killed. Hey, 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 hey. We'll be right back.
Oh my god. I don't know the way. Yeah. The way John is laughing over here. I have to reread those lyrics. Oh, that was unreal. I can't believe it, but I'm actually speechless.